My understanding of what is required of me this morning is that we'll take the first hour until talk about, and we'll take the second hour, which might help scriptural roots of ministry. So we will take a stand-up break at 11 o'clock, and this first hour has to do with some sense. I want to give you some additional feeling of where we are, what the challenges are, where God is blessing us, where we have work to do, land to be possessed. My cardinal verse for this, which no doubt Lorne and others have used already, is Isaiah 54, 1-3. And I want to set what I'm talking about this morning in the context of lengthening the cords and strengthening the stakes. Sometimes you lengthen, sometimes you strengthen. Both are necessary, and often our work around the world goes in cycles. We've just been through a period of very rapid expansion, lengthening the cords. We need a period of strengthening now in many countries. These are turbulent days. Navigators in recent months have been arrested in Jordan, chased by fanatical Muslims in Nigeria, thrown out of Egypt, denied visas in India, abducted in what was Yugoslavia. There is a cost to the gospel, as well as an excitement. So this, I want to give you the flavor of some of this morning. The other thing that I want to say by way of a general introduction is, because of the time and because of what is asked of me today, we will not take time to sketch in the wider work of the body of Christ around the world. So I make no apology for talking about us, but please don't hear that as arrogance, as a self-centeredness, as a preoccupation with how good we are as a mission agency, that we have the inside track somehow on God's blessing. This is, of course, not true, but I will talk this morning about the navigators and only the navigators. As it says in Matthew, every plant that my heavenly Father hath not planted will be rooted up. And that's the context in which we want to talk this morning. Because if it's of us, if it's in the flesh, it's dead. There will be no third generation, there will be no blessing. You have, in addition to all the good things that you've received in the last few days, four handouts for this hour. A green 10-page handout, which is the main one that I'll be using. A cream additional handout, which gives a different way of describing who we are and what we do, and has particular reference to the international team on which I work. In fact, the last page of it talks a little bit about Jerry and myself and Jim Peterson and Paul Stanley. These are the team of four brothers based here at Glen Eyrie and traveling most of the time. In fact, Peterson and Stanley are in Indonesia at the moment. I was in Poland on Sunday, just got back from there. I'll tell you a little bit about that maybe later in the hour. So the cream one we won't be working off. Then this new brochure, which Jerry sent you, I believe, in a recent letter, which Paul Stanley and I were working on in the fall, and we're encouraged by the reception, particularly outside the USA, as well as here, by this. And then one other thing that I should mention, this little newsletter, Worldwide, you have that? How many of you already subscribe to this? Just a few. Well, it's free. We send it out approximately every quarter. And what we're trying to do, it's really designed not for staff, but for the American men and women who support us financially, the four of us. And so we try and tell a little bit about the trips we've been taking, a little bit about what's going on in the world, and then in rotation, each of us gives somewhat of a devotional on the back page, and this happens to be one that I did, the latest issue. So if you would like a copy of Worldwide, let my secretary, Janet, know during the course of the week. Janet is part of this conference. You met Janet Yeager, so I think you're all right, or phone her on 2203. Good. That's by way of introduction. In terms here of what we have on the green handout, I won't work through this page by page because I'm going to work also off some slides. But let me just say, with reference to page 2, that we have in the Navigators, as you well know, both a vision and an aim. In general terms, the vision speaks to the heart, the aim speaks to the mind. Most of us would say, I think, that this aim, which we have now had for about 15 years, is not something that you wake up in the morning and leap out of bed chanting. It's carefully crafted by Lonsani and others. It has content in every word, but it isn't necessarily instantly exciting. However, I personally feel that vision statements are more exciting. This particular vision statement that you see here on page 2 is the one that appeals to the four of us working on the international team at this stage. And there are many other vision statements. Typically, every major country in the Navigators has its own statement, such as the one which you have, vision, task, purpose, and so forth for the USA. These statements, therefore, are not to be viewed as replacing the US statement or the Danish statement, but think of these international statements as a rather large and capacious umbrella under which the more specific statements of the individual countries, such as the USA, should fit and do fit nicely. Okay? Our strategic target here on page 2 is the major nations of the world. But before we get into that, I'd like you to look at page 3. I warned you that I would dance around here, but I think it'll work. Page 3 talks about our global society. These two words are paradoxical. Global has overtones of pomposity. Society has overtones, at least in British English, almost of feebleness. You have societies to collect butterflies. You have societies to study marshland. So we're a global society. What do we mean by a society? We mean something that is neither as tight and controlled as an organization, nor as loose and blurred and unfocused as a fellowship. Halfway between the looseness of a fellowship and the rigidity of an organization is an animal which in Webster's dictionary is listed as a society, and it has two things in Webster's that are part of this definition that you see on page 3. It is voluntary, and it is in pursuit of a common purpose, such as collecting butterflies or multiplying laborers or whatever it may be. Voluntary is very important, and so is the common purpose. I'll talk a little bit more about that in connection with the SRM, as it's an explanation, really, of why we have the SRM around the world. Now, if we go back to the age when dinosaurs roamed the Navigator world, say about 15 to 20 years ago, after I'd got out of my cigarette company, but long time ago, we really had three ways in which we sought to make ourselves effective. We had policies, very good policies, very clear policies. We had a strategy, particularly a global strategy, which we drafted and agreed in 1972, which in a space of about 60 pages defined everything that we were going to do until the year 2000. By the way, reality is very messy, and we soon gave up global strategies. But we had policies, we had strategy, and then the third thing we had was definition in terms of one's job description, one's particular responsibilities, and this was usually approved by a supervisor and so on. So in many places, that third one still exists. We have replaced, globally, policies, strategy, and what I would call structure, with three other things: vision, values, and relationships. And that statement that I've just made is very key to understanding and interpreting our worldwide work today. The three things in which we are interested, and they are in the prose on page 3, they appear in various phrases: vision, values, and relationships. Vision and values alone are not enough. I was on my way to Europe in October in a 767 Boeing. It has two engines. It flies across the Atlantic. One of them exploded. We were left with one engine. We were 2 hours from land. We came back, and I was put with the other passengers quite safely into a curious little hotel called the Albatross Motel in St. John, Newfoundland. It was a very appropriate name. The point that I wish to make is this. I picked up the local newspaper, and a whole page in the newspaper was given to a statement by the city of St. John, Newfoundland. And it said, St. John, the civic, the city statement, vision and values. And there it was. This is our vision as a city. These are our values. My point is that everybody has vision and values now. They're very popular. Christians also have relationships. We shall be known by our love. Vision, values, and relationships. So we don't have any longer, internationally, a hierarchical structure. Hence this curious-looking chart. It doesn't start at the top with some leaders and then go to the bottom with some peasants. Instead, the whole idea is circular. Now, I cannot represent a 90-country, 50-nationality organization or society on this chart. But I just want to show you here in the flavor of this. Here's the executive team. We function as a sort of central resource team to the work around the world. And here are the people who are responsible with their own teams, which we don't have space to list, for the work in various countries. So, for example, Africa is led by an Englishman, Mike Trunia. And you met Ilya Marjam, the African. He's on his leadership team, and some Nigerians and Kenyans also. There's the USA with Terry Taylor and his team here. So the point here, global society is really a committed community. That's a phrase by a man called Charlie Mellis, who wrote a book on the subject a dozen years or so ago. We're a committed community. We want to be interdependent. We want to be a partnership. And this page 3 describes some of the features of that. Now, notice one of the things here on page 3 under basic concepts is that we are trying to encourage covenantal commitments. That's the last thing there under basic concepts. Very quickly, let me contrast for you a covenant and a contract. A contract has to do with who employs you. A contract is a legal piece of paper. A covenant is a spiritual thing. A covenant is the sort of thing that David and Jonathan had. A covenant is entered into freely. It's based on trust. It's vulnerable and transparent. It flows both ways. It's very intense relationally. And it's binding in spite of circumstances. More and more in the navigators around the world, we are trying to foment, to stimulate, to encourage covenantal relationships. Because since we don't have a structure, we don't have policies, and we don't have strategy, we will rise or fall in the providence of God according to the quality of the way we relate to one another and the degree of trust that we place in one another. So, for example, when I hear a year ago that our brothers and sisters in India have stopped have done a Bible study and have concluded that really baptism is not of the essence in the Christian faith. It's not one of the things that is necessarily needed in converting Hindus. I don't say, that's heresy. I say, I know those people. I've met them. I've seen their depth in the scriptures. I will trust them until next time I am in India, when I may ask them to open the scriptures and talk to me about what they're thinking. You see the difference? In a covenantal commitment, you don't judge people unheard. You give them the benefit of the doubt. Okay. The rest of that I will not spend any time on, except to just draw your attention to the word enabling in the statement at the top. The whole purpose of the Global Society is to help us be more fruitful in our ministries around the world, to enable us. Then you have page 4, a page called The Navigators of the Nations, is packed with statistics. Let me just summarize much of what's on page 4 in a couple of slides. Now remember, what is the aim of the navigators? To multiply staff? No. To multiply spiritual laborers. Problem: spiritual laborers cannot be counted. I've just been in Poland, as I told you. I understand there were 120 people down in the valley near our place last weekend having a navigator conference. But I don't know whether that's the total work or whether there's 1,000 people in the total work or what. We don't need to count, we don't want to count, we don't intend to count the lay men and women for whose sake we exist. But we still can count our staff because a dear lady in the US building puts out a worldwide staff list and we can have a look at that and count. So here we are. The general impression you need to get is that the number of our staff has been increasing at 5% per year over the last decade. We're now something over 3,300. The 1993 figures, a little bit delayed, will be out in a couple of weeks when I've finished working on them. This, of course, naturally includes wives. Every time we talk about our staff around the world, we include wives. More interesting than the number is the number of nationalities, nearly 50. And more interesting still is that 2 years ago, we went through what I think is an important psychological milestone. There are now more than 100 languages, not just that navigators speak, but that navigators minister in, preach in, teach in, counsel in. And that's very, very encouraging to me, and that is increasing year by year. This chart emphasizes another point, the development of the Africans and Asians. In 1982, for example, there were just under 200 Africans and Asians on our staff. Now there are more than 600. So we are seeing more and more the emergence. Maybe later we'll talk a little bit about the shape of the church in the world today. But broadly speaking, the church is becoming more southern, more charismatic, more feminine, more holistic, and more radical. Five characteristics of the church today around the world. Generalizing somewhat. Generalizing a lot. But you'll let me get away with it. But anyway, 20% now of our staff are Africans and Asians, and 22% of our staff, in fact, come from the developing world. We have a relatively small work in terms of staff in Latin America. Another thing that's on this page four, is a statement of our established countries. That's a piece of jargon. What we basically mean is the countries that are the mature partners in our work around the world. There used to be just one, the USA. Now there are, in fact, 25. And in each of these, three criteria are met. Biblically rooted, culturally relevant, and continuously effective. In other words, if we pulled out the missionaries, if we didn't do anything more for them, the work is multiplying under God of its own. Okay, that was page four. Maybe just on page four, a couple of things, just to illuminate with people these statistics. You'll notice in number one on page four, let me pick a couple of nationalities. Burmese. For 15 years or so, the navigators have had a work in Burma. There are no foreign missionaries there from the West. We have probably about a dozen staff of several different peoples. Let me tell you about one of them. A woman of about 50 years old. Her name is Se Bay. She's a single woman. She has a work up on the coast of Burma, or Myanmar as it's now called, among a group of people called the Sea Gypsies. These are people who sail up and down that particular coast, and they still engage quite frequently in minor acts of piracy. There were more acts of piracy in the world last year than there were in any previous year in the last 10 years. Where do you think most acts of piracy occur? What part of the world? In the straits between Singapore and Malaysia and Indonesia. It's a very dangerous place. Pirates come at night, armed to the teeth, come up the side of the boat, take over, take your cargo, go down, disappear within the hour. Lots of piracy. Surprising. We thought it went out with Bluebeard or Blackbeard or whatever his name was. But there's increasing piracy in the world today. Back to Sebe. Sebe has translated the New Testament into the language of the Sea Gypsies. Sebe is meeting with a number of them, both men and women, and Sebe, in a very strong and beautiful way, is discipling this people. And she's someone that we should remember in our prayers. So we have a work in Burma. Koreans. Probably in many ways the second largest work after the USA and the Navigator World. When I was there in November, I was struck by how radically different the Korean culture is from our culture here. I would not be standing casually slouching here without my jacket on in Korea. Foreign visitors, especially foreign visitors who spend a lot of money on the air ticket, always wear suits in Korea. The women will sit on this side, the men will sit on this side. Everything I say will be taken down verbatim. So I'll say something, and then all the heads go down, and then I say something else, heads go down. I tell you, I don't want to mock this. I want to tell you I respect it, because it is highly contextualized. The Korean culture is disciplined, focused. The Korean Navigator Ministry is built on spiritual commitment and all-night prayer. Thousands of young Koreans come to Christ each year through this ministry of the Navigators. At the National University, which is the largest ministry, we field 5 soccer teams, Navigator 1, Navigator 2, etc. And usually they take off the top 5 places within the intramural university deal. An amazing ministry, radically different, very beautiful. Although they're so committed, you look at the smiles on their faces, and you listen to what they want to talk to you about when you visit them. Grace is what they're interested in talking about. Now, almost everybody who's a young disciple in the Korean ministry goes into training apartments, like it used to be here in the USA 20, 25 years ago. Okay? I came in from the outside laterally, so I missed that. But it's an interesting thing, the training apartment. So I asked, well, what happens for some of the people who are perhaps not quite, even by Korean standards, so disciplined? Oh, and they smiled, and John Pyun said to me, we have grace apartments. In grace apartments, you get up at 6 o'clock, not at 4:30. Special. Special. Okay. That's what some of us need, grace apartments. Let me mention the Poles, one other nationality, and then I'll press on here, just to give you a little bit of a flavor of the diversity of our work. As I say, I had the privilege of being with 4 of our Polish leaders and our Central European group for the last few days in a little place in southern Poland, the home, the cottage home of a couple called Vladek and Eva. They have been with the Navigators for about 15 years through the hard times of communism, where this little home up in the forest on the hillside was very, very useful to them because it just wasn't very visible. It was out of the way. Someone has made the comment humorously that being Polish is not a nationality, it's a profession. And I like that. They are the most irrepressible people. They greet you by pummeling you. So I am quite sore, and I know I'm their friend. So I told them about the Koreans, and they all lined up at the end of my 4 days with them, and they did this to me. Because I told them that age is revered in Korea. When they met me at the airport in Korea, very discreetly, they wanted to know how old I was. They found out I was 2 years older than their country leader, so they knew where I fitted on the scale. Isn't that interesting? So different from here. In America, youth is king. There, grayness is king. Okay, both need correcting by the scriptures, incidentally. So the Poles. The Poles have an insatiable missionary vision. Our Polish friends just get into their old cars and they drive eastward into Ukraine, into Tatarstan, where they've seen several hundred Muslims come to Christ through the work particularly of a Polish fellow by the name of Adam, and on through Siberia, and they go almost all the way to Vladivostok. They have this propensity to seek out the loneliest places, the least reached places. You're aware that through the commission and many other ventures, tremendous amount of effort is being focused on cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg. The Poles are looking for the gaps between that effort. So they keep going way past Moscow and St. Petersburg, and they have a disciple-making ministry in high schools and local church ministry, particularly with Muslims in various parts of the Soviet Union. Very precious. I had this vision, by the way, that one day the navigators of the West, that's the Poles, and the navigators of the East, that's the Koreans, because they also move around strongly in the Soviet Union that was, they'll meet somewhere in the middle of Russia and there'll be a giant celebration. And the men with suits and the men with beer and beards will meet. And there will be a foretaste of heaven and the many splendid grace of God and the diversity of it all. Okay, we need to keep pressing here. Let me talk a little bit about the nations. You will have seen on page 2 that we have a statement about what a major nation is, and it's repeated on page 5. And it might be important just to spend a moment or two on this. I think we realize that the Great Commission in Matthew 28 uses the word ethnos, or nation. This is not the same as a country. Okay? Ethnos is a very general word. It's used in the New Testament era for platoons of soldiers, for swarms of bees, for the Gentiles plus the Jews. It's extremely elastic. Parenthesis, therefore, some aspects of American evangelical missiology, when they use the word ethnos just to mean a people group, like racetrack dwellers in the San Fernando Valley, that is stretching the use of the word ethnos in the Bible. That's pushing the outer envelope of the way it should be used, in my opinion. Okay, now, a major nation. This is the strategic target of the navigators. We don't have objectives, I told you that, but we still have a target, a prayer target. We want to be in every nation of more than 1 million people, defined in terms of having 1 million people of that nationality or in that language group or in that country in the year 2000. Now, I said just now that countries were not really the way to go, but we have to remember that the Apostle John, in the book of Revelation, who speaks 7 times about the people who will be around the throne of God, rejoicing, singing, each time he uses the word ethnos, he uses the word laos, or people, and he uses the word glossa, or language. Only once does he use the word basileia, or country. But we live at the end of the 20th century. We need visas. We have passports. We have nationalities. And so it makes sense also to talk about countries. How are the navigators doing then in terms of peoples and languages and countries? There are approximately, as can be seen on page 5, 440 major nations, that is ethne, or plural ethnoses, of more than 1 million people. 243 peoples, 345 languages, we know the languages rather exactly, 155 countries, we know that rather exactly. Peoples, a lot of debate. Very difficult to define a people. I won't get into that now, but we have a list of 243 and we have reasons for using this number. And you see down there the navigator presence is on this overhead here. We have a presence in around 130 of the 440 major nations. So there is a tremendous amount of land still to be possessed. A tremendous amount of enlarging the place of our tent still required. Of course, we have to fit in with the rest of the body and want to do so and do so. On page 6, one of the more interesting things that comes out of this analysis is that here's the list of the most populous or the largest peoples, languages, and countries which do not yet have a navigator ministry. Many of my friends use this as a prayer page. Let's just, for simplicity, look at the countries. And let me encourage you by saying that next September, Lord willing, 3 Malaysian couples will settle in Bangladesh to initiate the navigator ministry there. By the way, that's confidential. You saw on the front green page. In fact, all of this is confidential. It's for your eyes as staff. It's not to be handed around because some of the countries and so on that we talk about here, we prefer not to talk about in public. So we're going to start a ministry in Bangladesh. And then 2 months ago, Bob Fredano and 2 other people with experience with us in the Middle East surveyed Morocco and Tunisia. They did not go into Algeria, which was prudent, because Algeria is in a mood to kill foreigners at the moment. You probably kept up with this in the papers. It's a very dangerous place to be a foreigner in. But we have surveyed Morocco and Algeria, and we will probably start a ministry in Morocco within the next year. Now notice, very simply, all the easy places are taken, right? Afghanistan, Mozambique, these are not easy places. North Korea, more and more, this is the way it will be. The challenge will increase rather than decrease as the day of the Lord comes nearer. That's the way it is. It's mapped out in the scriptures, and that's what we can expect. We are surveying many places. Here is an example of the places we surveyed in the year 1992. We surveyed 17 countries. The previous year, 10 countries. I refer to the fact that we have been in a period of lengthening the cords. One of the things that this mysterious concept called a global society did for us is that it decentralized everything totally. So you no longer had to wait for some memo of approval from someone in Colorado Springs to go and survey Guatemala. You just did it. And that's what's been happening. And if we are fortunate, I tend to get a copy of the survey report within 3 months after it happened. We do not know often in advance here when these surveys are occurring. But the number is increasing each year, and the commitment of our people around the world to reach out into the frontiers and into new peoples is very strong. Surveys, of course, are one thing. Starting a ministry is a more complex thing. You might be interested to see that in the 1970s, we entered just under 2 countries per year. In the 1980s, we entered just under 4 countries per year. A little bit of that comparison is apples and oranges because there were some new countries invented in the 1980s, which we happen to have entered earlier. But a lot of new countries. Look at this. 15 new countries in the USSR alone. You won't be able to see this but there's a scale here from 1980 to 1994, and in 1980, it shows you by year. For example, in 1980, we had a ministry in Ukraine, Russia, and Latvia. Okay, traveling ministry. And then when the Black Line kicks in, we have resident people. So we had resident people in Russia from 1984. But it's too much detail there, really, for the... The interesting thing about this is over on the right. I noticed the light is not too powerful there. The people that the navigators currently have working in Eurasia, which is our name for the new USSR, these 15 countries, look at the diversity. Americans, British, Finns, Norwegians, Poles, Romanians, Dutch, Swedes, Koreans, of course, Canadians, and Russians. All staff, all part of the wonderful fabric of our partnership at this time. Now, see what else we have here. There's a page 7, the state of missions in our global society. I put this in because I thought you might be interested in just knowing how I feel about some of the trends that are emerging in the navigators, and you can see seven of them there. This is part of a longer list. I've told you that we've been, number one, lengthening the cords, and I've shown you evidence for that. More and more, number two, we are crossing cultures in our own countries. For example, Anglos, WASPs in the USA, are working among Hispanics, like Larry Blake in Denver, moving to Florida. One of the best examples at the moment, and the most satisfying examples of this, is our Indian staff. We have a dozen Indian couples who are, in our terms, staff, and all of them came up in southern India in a predominantly nominal Christian environment. 4 years ago, they got together, they went through the SRM process, and they felt that God was telling them to move north. Not all of them, but half of these couples now have moved north into the Hindu heartland of India. That's what Ralph Winter would call E3 difference, strongly cross-cultural. Different language, different ethnicity, different religion. Everything is different when you compare places like Bangalore and Hyderabad in the south with places up in Uttar Pradesh and around there in northern India. So there's a tremendous amount of cross-cultural movement in the navigators within our major countries. Missions from the developing world. I've talked to you about the Koreans and the Poles. The Koreans have very ambitious missionary targets. They will be probably putting 100 or more missionaries into China, Mongolia, Eastern Siberia, and places like that in the next few years. Cooperation without fusion, that's a rather complex phrase. What I basically mean is we're doing something in the navigators that we weren't doing 10 years ago. We tended to be rather insular, rather set on our own part of the action. Now we have things like the commission, where we are actively cooperating with other agencies and with churches, and yet not organizationally amalgamating. Okay? And there are other examples as well. The commission is clearly the biggest one, but it is a trend in the navigators and not just in the American navigators. Lay participation, it has to come. And in fact, I have noted down here that not only lay participation we want, but lay ownership. We don't just say, would you like to join my thing and be a part of it? We want laymen and women, don't we, to actually take off and go after it themselves, as they are increasingly doing. Multicultural teams, that's happening more and more. Multiple sending centers. Here in the USA, we don't just have, like we used to have, one central computerized department which sends American missionaries overseas. We now have at least four of the larger U.S. entities which have their own missions strategy. The Business and Professional Ministry in the U.S., for example, has just placed Dwight Hill in Singapore. The U.S. Military Ministry, which some of you are part of, is very much interested in Russia, also in other places such as the Philippines and Australia. Not just with Americans. We've always been interested in overseas U.S. military bases, but with nationals in these countries. So multiple sending by multiple entities makes things much more confusing and much more exhilarating. Okay, those are some observations on emerging trends in the navigators. And then I have some issues that we're wrestling with. Let me pick out a couple of these. Number three, missions out of weakness. I think for too long here in America, and I speak as an American because I've lived here 18 years, for too long, we've been used to just getting hold of the resources, going overseas, spending the money, spending the time, using the computers to do what we know needs to be done. Within the next 10 years, we are going to have to experience what people from the developing world experience. Less resources, less money, more weakness, and if I may say so, a closer parallel to the way mission was done in the New Testament. It is very important, if we want to be incarnational, that we be vulnerable. It is very important that we come as close as we can to identify with the level of the people whom we are seeking to reach. That's incarnation. Not just truth, but grace as well. So we're seeing this more and more, and we are going to have to learn a lot about what it means to do missions out of weakness. There's a great deal in the New Testament about this. But it hasn't been an area in which we have majored, either practically or theologically. Then, penetrating the mainstreams. Mainstreams I use as a term to describe the major people or major religion. For example, we have just formed an international working group. This is an anonymous sort of title. It's basically a group of five or six people who are giving themselves full-time to penetrating Islam. Though, if you like, it's an Islamic working group. There are 17 countries where the navigators have a ministry among Muslims. I mentioned Tatarstan, the Middle East, of course, is where we have 70% of our resources. We are spending this year, through these six people, Bob Badano, Jim Peterson, and others, visiting each of these 17 countries, understanding and getting hold of the best experience we can find, the best ideas in the body of Christ, the best solutions to this very intractable problem of how to reach Muslims. And we are determined, because of our commitment to all nations, to significantly be used of God among Islamic peoples. an area that needs enormous prayer. The two large people movements that we know of among Muslims at the moment are in Bangladesh, where some would say that 100,000 people have come to Christ who were Muslims, and in northern Nigeria, where there's a movement of the Spirit of God. In both these places, in the last year, there have arisen internal dissensions, arguments between nationals and ministries, fighting over who owns what and who does what and who's important and who's not. The devil is very, very active, as we know, in this area of Islam. So we need great prayer and great wisdom, but our commitment to the nations doesn't offer us any alternative other than to go ahead harder and faster, and we hope more wisely than we have yet done. Then I give some background factors here on page 7, and you see them there. Of course, we talked about Islam. Tribalism. Every one of these, by the way, we could unwrap and look at. Let me just perch for a moment very briefly on tribalism, because I want you to think about these factors and don't just say tribalism. Yes, I know what that means. That's Yugoslavia. Well, sure it is. But it's lots of other places too. There are 35 major wars in the world today, according to the Stockholm Peace Institute, who monitor these things. Every one of them is an inter-ethnic war. The last non-ethnic war, if you like, was the Gulf War. That was just a squabble over oil and prestige and who owns that part of the world and so on. But every one of these 35 wars is an ethnic war. And it's getting worse. You've seen the news from Rwanda. And you see, what happened was that the Cold War kept the lid on the garbage cans of human nature. You lined up with the evil empire, the Russians, and you were on their side, or you lined up with the beautiful people, the Americans, and you were on their side. And everyone was a client of one of the big two. So ethnicity was erased and suppressed as a factor. The issue was, are you communist or are you capitalist? Now we've dismantled that control structure, we find out again that sin is there all the time. And that I just don't like being around people who are not like me. And most of the time, nor do you. Although you've learned to be gracious about it. Okay? So we hate. The British don't like the French and they don't like the Irish. General rule, we most dislike the people who live closest to us. We can conceptualize the people who live halfway around the world and we're sure that we're full of love for them. But, you know, it's the people who are close to us that are difficult, right? And there are reasons why tribalism erupts. The colonialists drew the wrong borders. It's a shameful thing in West Africa that if you look at the map of West Africa, you see a country like Togo. It's a long snake going straight down to the sea. Why are countries drawn like that? Answer, because the British wanted to get gold and slaves out as expeditiously as possible. What do you need to get gold and slaves down to the sea and onto the boats? You need a long, narrow country that follows the course of a river to the sea. And you can get things really moving efficiently. We raped that continent, the Europeans, and it's not good. And that's why we have tribal wars in Africa now, because the colonialists drew the wrong borders because of their greed. I can say that because I'm British. We won't talk about American colonialism. Now, but the point I want to leave with you, there are various advantages of tribalism for the gospel. For example, people are in tension. People are in desperate need. People are refugees. All of these things open up men and women to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And there are disadvantages also of tribalism for the gospel. And so as we think about this and move into these situations around the world, we have to understand what tribalism does in terms of the extension of the kingdom and what it does not do. One of the disadvantages, of course, is the church gets marginalized. The church gets the blame. A lot of the divisions around the world that are really racial divisions are labeled as religious divisions. Okay, so that was just an example on tribalism. Let's have a look here at page 8. This is a rather daunting list of more than 20 current initiatives in navigator missions. And I want just to perch on number 22. We used to think that we're the senders, and over there in Africa somewhere, they're the receivers, right? Now we see that all of us can receive from other nationalities, and all of us can send. So we have something in the Navigators which we call a resource exchange. I was at one in Nigeria several years ago in the city of Enugu. A dozen of us went from the West and from North America, and a dozen Africans were there. We identified what we Westerners can do. We can send more full-time missionaries. We can send money, etc., etc. But more important, we identified what the Africans can give us that we need. They can give us examples and stories of faith, of perseverance, of how to live in very modest economic circumstances, missions out of weakness. When we get into this, we're going to learn from the Africans. They can show us what holistic ministry, word and deed, is really like. They have all sorts of intangible things which need to flow in our direction in the global society. We have most of the tangible things, the goodies, which flow in their direction. It's a beautiful way that God has put this together so that we can learn from one another and share with one another. And this is resulting in additional impetus in missions. Access. I'm going to round things off here before 11 with access. There are approximately 90 countries in the world which are still restricted. You cannot show up in the board and say, I'm a missionary, visa please. It does not go well for you. The Navigators are in about 40 of these. We have a bias to getting into these countries. We want to be in the hard places of the world, and we want to make spiritual laborers. So whereas our staff as a whole is growing at 5% per year, the number of people we're putting into these countries, you'll notice, is growing at 7% per year. The reason for the dip here was in Central Europe. No, I can't get into that. It's fascinating, but it'll take too long. We won't talk about Central Europe. Just notice that the dip has been recovered from. All right? What do I mean when I talk about access? Internationally, we're talking about a partnership of commitments in the Navigators. Not a structure, but a partnership of commitments to secure and sustain an authentic presence for ministry. 15 years ago, we thought the whole point was to get the visa. So we did things which were pathetic, looking back on it. And I was part of this. We have one fellow who spent 9 years in a university in Croatia learning about medieval Croatian history. Till one day they came and said, you don't need to know that much, do you? Out. It wasn't authentic. It wasn't relevant. It was phony. Okay? We have people who kept selling corn dollies and garages in America stacked with corn dollies and Polish hula hoops and so on, because people said we're in the import-export business and no such thing. We serve the Prince of Truth. So we should not be inventing fictitious jobs and pretending to be what we are not. That's what the word authentic means. And the word presence has to do with John 1:14. Jesus was not only human, but it says in John 1:14 in the Greek, he put up his tent next to our tent in the mud and the dirt and so forth of Galilee. So, access is about sustaining an authentic presence for ministry. There are 8 different ways in which we approach access, and they're on page 9. Let me tell you that only 2 are strategic priorities. That doesn't mean the others are wrong. If you're involved in the others, that's fine. But in countries where the issue is survival, Ethiopia, Sudan, Rwanda, we're encouraging micro-enterprises, very small businesses. However, in countries where the issue is development, not survival, we're encouraging 3, institutes. Almost everybody in the developing world is interested in 3 things. They want to learn English, they want to develop some basic computer skills, and they want to know how to run a little business, how to manage their life and themselves and their family. We have more than 50 navigators who are owning, running, managing language institutes, teaching English, teaching other languages. We have about another 30 staff who are involved in management consultancies in the developing world, etc., etc. Not in order to stay in the country and earn money in order to do, quote, the ministry, unquote, in the evening, but because work 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. is the way we incarnate Jesus Christ in many of these situations. The concept of a full-time, gift income-supported person is weird in the extreme, even in a country like France. If you're supported by gift income and you're not a Catholic priest, you must be a Jehovah's Witness. You know, there isn't anything in between. You're a cult. Okay, so we are moving more and more into the frontiers. The frontiers are of many types. There's a political frontier. 61% of the world's people don't have the sort of political liberties that we have. There's an educational frontier. 23% of the world's adults are still illiterate, and it's not getting any better. Now, our particular calling is not literacy, but we can team with literature and missions in the sort of cooperation that I talked about. Religious frontier, social frontier. Never think that frontiers are just out there, and because we live in America, there's nothing here to be done. I think one of the most difficult social frontiers in the postmodern, ambiguous, incoherent, fragmented culture we live in here in America is Southern California. It is a frontier for the gospel. It is a very difficult frontier. There is superficial religiosity, there are cults all over the place, and there is an absence of authentic discipleship and commitment to Jesus Christ, which is scary. There are frontiers all around us, pagan frontiers, relativism, secularism, etc. So much for the frontiers. And then I give you, in the light of all this, because I know that I'm painting sometimes what may seem a gloomy picture, page 10 has prayer requests, which is an appropriate way to close. Mike or Larry, should we take a couple of questions or should we have our break and go on to the SRM?
I think we probably would like to ask a question.
Let's have some fast questions and some slick answers. Huh? Yes?
We started about urban frontiers.
Yes.
44% of the world's people live in metropolitan areas.
Yes.
What is the overall trend? Like in the United States, it's 79% of our people live in.
Yeah. It's increasing by between 1% and 2% a year. So 50% of the world's people by the year 2000 will live in cities. It's happening fastest in Africa and in Latin America. Yes?
Put on the horizon for Afghanistan, Iran, and say Iranian American.
The Iranian American ministries may well be our point of entry, our key to Iran. The Navigators used to have a ministry in Iran. While the Shah was still here, it was run by my brother-in-law. It collapsed. He had a brain aneurysm. He's buried in Shiraz. Interesting story. Someday my wife and I hope to visit his grave. So there's a little bit in me that is praying all the time that we start again in Iran. Your point is an important point. Very generally, one way in which we do missions nowadays is by finding that the world has come to America. And so we can start work among Afghanis by finding the largest community of Afghanis in the USA. You know that Abraham came from the Chaldees, Ur of the Chaldees? Like, where do you think the largest concentration of the Chaldeans is outside Iraq? Answer, Detroit. Very interesting. I didn't even know there were Chaldeans until recently. So we're not actually planning anything in Iran. Well, We do have a prayer group focused on Iran. We have no current plans for Afghanistan. Yes? Don.
Don, on the page 7 on the issues, could you
A missiology for the poor. Again, everything that we talk about comes back to our passion for the nations. If we weren't committed to every nation, we wouldn't really have to think about what it means to be a navigator, to make disciples among the poor. We need to develop a way, and we are beginning to develop a way, where we can so simplify our methodology and so increase the love of our hearts for people unlike ourselves, most of us are middle class probably, that we can really stand beside the poor and not just minister to them, but minister among them. The sort of missiology that is needed for the poor will have to be more holistic. Bread, as well as the promise of a future insurance plan that gets you to heaven will be required. There are a few Navigator models in Indonesia, in Chicago, in other places already, and we will probably bring these people together that they can share with one another. More and more, we learn from one another, not by bringing our directors together, but by bringing together the people most interested and most experienced in a particular area. I can't really get into what would be the features of such a missiology, but we have work to do. Yes?
How many Navigator staff are there in other countries besides the United States?
I think that at approximately 1,800 in the U.S., so there are 3,300 in total, so the answer is 1,500. Yes? Yes. Millennial ferment. I could get carried away at this point, but I must be very careful. In America and many other countries, there is something called the AD 2000 movement. Excellent movement. Full of faith. Full of vision. In the last 10 years, 300 new plans have been written to evangelize the world by AD 2000. Now, if I seriously thought that Jesus was coming in AD 2000, I would rush to join one of these plan makers. Or I would join Campus Crusade, and I would just get the word out. Hire a balloon, whatever is necessary. But a lot depends on your eschatology. We believe that Jesus is coming soon, but we do not believe that he is constrained by a particular date. I do not believe that God is particularly impressed by the fact that a few years from now, AD 2000 will come. I don't think it's a major thing in his calendar. I really don't. He may come this year. He may not come for 10,000 years. But all around us are mission agencies frothing up the idea that we've got to get the job done by 2000. And if I may say so, with a modicum of grace behind the words, it can be very diversionary. So I want to encourage the people who are doing this. But I don't want us Navigators to get involved in how will I reach America within 6 years. Our particular calling does not involve anything within 6 years. Thanks, Ken, for the question. I hope I've been charitable at that point. I really pray for these folk. Yes?
I'd like to know about the four horsemen.
Yes. What do you want to know about them? You are well aware, Larry, that in the book of Revelation... yes. The four horsemen of the apocalypse are basically conquest, civil war, famine, and pestilence. All these four conditions are increasing in the 1990s. Conquest, civil war, famine, and pestilence. Even though I make negative noises about AD 2000, I want to balance that by saying we are in conditions that are ripe for the soon coming of our Lord. And we need to be ministering in a way which recognizes these desperate realities. 500,000 people have been killed in Rwanda in the last month. And you know, with the headlines here, when 10 people get into a helicopter crash in Georgia or something, it's a banner headline. Where is our sense of proportion? We have work to do as believers. We have to get the gospel out before people are taken. So those are the four horsemen, as you well know. You were fishing for something there. You didn't get it. One more question.
This one's a little bit of a struggle, so I'm sort of speaking yes. from perhaps an African-American perspective. But as I look at the four of you, and I know all four of you, mm-hmm. with a lot of respect to Jewish people, yeah. and as I look at the country, you have the international leaders, basically everybody's Caucasian.
Yep.
Possible exception of all of them.
It's a serious...
Half your country.
Yeah. Touché. Your point is very valid. We're very concerned about it. People have said, we love this brochure, but look at these four gray, pale males on the back. This is not good. It's not good gender-wise. It's not good Caucasian-wise. Now, There's a very real difficulty here. We don't want to engage in tokenism. We don't want to promote people just because their skin color is different from us. And the problem is this. The best non-American leaders we have are leading their countries. For us to pull them out of that root system, bring them to Colorado or somewhere, say, learn what it is to live in America, learn what it is to work with pale males, and it's just is destructive. It will, in many ways, tend to slow the gospel down rather than to encourage it. So what we do, we have a commitment, the four of us, to bring more people here. And every year we bring a different person here, preferably from the developing world. We're not doing as well as we should do on that. Next year, for example, because of the very criticism you're making, in May we will have an international council. We have them every 2 years. There will be 40 people there, and there will be a major presence by Africans, Asians, and women. But we're behind. One other problem we have is you cannot bring people into the heart or the center of what we're doing if they are not becoming available in the countries. Now, what I mean by that is until in the U.S., for example, the African American and the Hispanic ministries become a larger part of the total U.S. ministry, we cannot easily look to the U.S. ministry for international leaders from those communities. The same applies in a number of other countries. So we're sensitive, we're very much needing to be criticized, and I appreciate your point. No central defense. We must stop, I think. Thanks very much.